Hello, everyone, and welcome to Wild Hearts, the podcast dedicated to sharing the stories and lessons from the founders and operators changing the world.
We were just talking through one of the areas to improve that we identified, and we were talking through it like it was a design problem. And we were just laughing about how everything's a design problem. But it's true. It's just a way to solve problems.
That's Lucy Denton, head of design at Dovetail, and this is Wild Hearts. Today is the second episode from our operator series. The first was all about interviewing a world-class growth operator, and today is all about interviewing a world-class designer from a company synonymous with design, Dovetail. Every single organization conducts research of some form, and therefore, Dovetail's mission is to improve the quality of everything. They do it by helping companies understand the oxygen tank of that company, its customers. Lucy Denton started at Dovetail as the first design hire when there was only five people, and then she's been there through it all as the company has scaled and has earned the right to become the head of design. It's wild how much we've covered, honestly, in this episode. Everything from Dovetail's end-to-end product building process, which hint is led by design, to what high-quality individual designers deliver, to the core challenges that Lucy faced while the organization grew, to growing into that head of design role and tying business outcomes with design. And so we really cover the full arc of a designer's career, from starting to growing to leading a design-led business. And it was a lot of fun. So if you're a designer, you work with designers, or you're interested in how one of the best companies on the planet executes, then this is for you. And so with that, here's the conversation with Lucy. Thank you for joining me. Let's get stuck in. I want to start at the highest of all levels. At a company, what is the purpose of design?
Starting from the top.
Started from the bottom, now we're here.
Well, to put it simply, the purpose of design in a company is to solve customer problems, create innovative solutions that users will love to use, and differentiate the company in the market.
We're anchoring on customer love.
Yeah, that's what it's all about, customer centricity.
Love it. Okay, so you told me earlier that design at Dovetail takes a design-led approach. What is that? Why has Dovetail chosen that operating model?
Yeah, sure. A design-led approach to product development means that you start with a deep understanding of your users and then taking a very iterative approach to product discovery and development. You continue to focus on those user needs throughout that process. So being design-led means that you are continuously learning about your users and continuously improving the experience. And it also means that you have a very strong collaborative partnership between design and engineering so that you are able to foster that iterative product development process.
Talk a bit more about that. Maybe share an example of when Dovetail was operating at its best.
Yeah, I can share an earlier example. So when I first started at Dovetail, one of the first things I worked on was our video transcription feature, our video features, which is a big differentiating part of Dovetail, part of the product. And at that time, we knew we wanted to expand the product. We knew we wanted to build our next differentiating feature, but didn't know what that was going to be. We did have this feature in the product called Insights, which we know wasn't getting much product use, and we felt like there could be an opportunity there, but wanted to explore that further. So one of the first things that I worked on was a big research project to understand what those opportunities could be. And it could have gone two ways. We could have done some research to understand how people were using this feature called Insights, which probably would have led to some incremental improvements to that feature. But we wanted to understand how we could, you know, add more value to users' workflows and expand our product offering. So rather than that, we did a big generative research project where we interviewed 45 customers, non-customers, churned customers, and went really broad and asked them how they do research in their companies, how they think about research, how they prioritize research, how they work on research together. So not so much focusing on Dovetail the tool, but more just trying to understand the research landscape. And from that, we learned a lot about how companies do research. I think we came up with over 300 insights, which were user problems, opportunities, and just learnings about the research industry, which is huge, huge number of insights. So it's kind of an overwhelming amount of data.
It's too many.
That's a lot. So we create research journey and then bucketed our insights throughout that journey. And then from there, we went into a series of design workshops and involved the whole team. So this is where engineering and design get to work really closely together on the solution design, like what solution are we going to create to solve these user problems or lean into these opportunities? And that was a really fun process with the Dovetail team in the early days. We got the whole company involved at that time, which was about 12 people. And we went really broad on ideas for all of these different problems. And from that process, you could kind of see where we wanted to play as a product. Looking at this, you know, research journey, you could see what ideas were going to build off what we already have and kind of work with the Dovetail product, and what ideas solve some customer problems in the research industry, but might be difficult for us to execute on. For example, participant recruitment is a big pain point in a researcher's workflow. You've got to like schedule people, and there's NDAs to send out, and people don't show up. There's lots of pain points in that part of the workflow, but we hadn't invested in that before. There's lots of competitors in that market. There's lots of tools like Calendly and DocuSign that are used. So it didn't make sense as an area for us to play in. Whereas there were lots of opportunities around how stakeholders are brought into the research process, how research learnings are shared with stakeholders, how action is taken off the back of research, that flowed really well from the analysis and synthesis part of the process that we had already kind of built a product around. So from this project, we learned a lot about how we could lean into those opportunities. And from there, we went deeper into ideas around how we could solve some of those problems. And that's when we can start to take a more iterative approach to chipping away at those solutions.
And where did you land?
Well, from that project, we really started to invest in a new use case. So Dovetail started as this analysis tool. We called it a productivity tool for researchers. And as we learned more about how stakeholders want to consume research and researchers want to influence their stakeholders, we started to expand it to this new use case, which now we call an insights hub or a research repository, which is essentially the single source of customer information for an organization that anyone in a company can access and learn about customers from. So that's a huge opportunity. And there's a lot of granular features that make up that use case that we're still chipping away at. And that's where that continuous learning comes in as we develop into that use case. But that was the biggest outcome of that project.
And can you go a bit deeper into, using that as an example, the dance between the engineering team and, I think you must have been the only designer at the time. Like, what does that collaboration look like at Dovetail?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we call our engineers product engineers because they are so involved in the solution design process. We call it solution design. That's essentially where you come up with what the solution to the problem is going to be. So it's a very collaborative process. The designers, or myself at that time as the only designer, I was responsible for framing the problem and bringing that user understanding into the room and making sure that everyone understood that, heard from the customers, like playing video clips, making that problem really clear to the team. And then sourcing ideas, facilitating input from the team. What are all of the ideas that we can come up with, going broad? And then having that technical knowledge in the room to converge on what is the most pragmatic solution that we can build to solve this problem or learn something more about this. So it was a super collaborative process. And then I would go away and create the detailed designs And then again, there would be more back and forth on technical feasibility, or that's really difficult, that's going to take a long time, what trade-offs can we make? All the way to pairing on the actual implementation, testing the solution, sweating the details, and then pushing it out and then seeing what we can learn from it and bringing those learnings back to the team. So you're hand in hand the entire process.
I love that. So you just mentioned there, you call them product engineers. I'd be remiss to not mention that there was an AFR article talking about product managers no more. Can you share the decision making behind that article?
Yeah, so we had a small team of product managers at Dovetail. So our product team was made up of product managers, product designers, and product engineers. Our team is only about 40 people. And the challenge that we had was with so many people who have deep context of the users, an understanding of the product strategy, an understanding of the market, an understanding of competitors, and then the context of the business and how the product contributes to the business goals. We sort of had too many cooks in the kitchen, and there just wasn't enough scope for a full-time product management role. So we had this realization that product management is a craft at Dovetail, but it's just there isn't enough for it to be a full-time role at this point. And that craft is shared by product leadership, product designers, and product engineers. I think of design like a toolbox of skills and methods that you use to solve problems. And when you're starting out in your career, you're usually strong in one particular skill. And for me, that was UX. For some people, it's research. For some people, it's visual design or graphic design. And then as you get into the industry and you're exposed to different types of problems and work with different people, you start to build up your toolbox of different skills. You know, no one is ever strong at everything, but you start to build skills like facilitation and storytelling and systems thinking and information architecture. And then you sort of turn into a full stack product designer, is what some people call it.
Okay, so you were facing that dilemma, I imagine, before Atlassian. Did you land into UX, or was there a passion that led you there?
So I started at Atlassian as a graduate designer. So before that, I was at university and I did an HCI course, a human computer interaction course, which is basically UX. So I sort of learned about UX from there.
Yeah.
And I was lucky enough to get a graduate role at Atlassian, which is a very entry level position. So I started off knowing a few things about UX. And then I was so lucky to have joined Atlassian so early in my career, where I got to work alongside lots of amazing designers and learned a lot more about UX, and then got exposed to other design skills and methods and different types of problems and worked with some really talented people.
So from a base point of view, there's a pretty strong argument to be made that UX is a very good starting point in terms of which tool from the toolbox do I select?
Yeah, definitely. But design is such a broad function and there's so many skills and strengths in that toolbox that people come from really diverse backgrounds, which is one of the best things about design, is that it is very broad and there's a lot of variety in the role. So I've worked with people who've come from graphic design, industrial design, visual communications, even people who've come from something like journalism and they have really strong storytelling skills. All of that is design and it's valuable. There are lots of different ways to solve a problem and to influence a group of people, and all of that is design. So it really depends on, yeah, what your strengths are. People have their natural strengths that they tend to lean more towards. There are many different ways to end up in design. If you are looking to get into design, I would say UX is a good starting point because you learn kind of basic problem framing and problem solving skills. But there are many different pathways.
So you joined Dovetail, I believe, as number 5, and you came with the backdrop of UX experience at Atlassian. Was that experience enough for you to hit the ground running? Maybe share what the first few months were like at Dovetail.
Yeah, sure. So I worked at Atlassian for 5 years as a designer, and then I joined Dovetail as a senior product designer. So yeah, I had the skills to hit the ground running. I had also worked with Benjamin previously at Atlassian. Benjamin's the CEO of Dovetail and also comes from a product design background. So we already knew each other, which was a good starting point. So one of the first things that I worked on at Dovetail was our video features and then some of our table stakes product features. Like I worked on the editor and the tagging feature and the commenting feature. And then we knew we wanted to grow the product and build that next differentiating feature, which was when I got started on that big research project that I was talking about previously. And I had just been fortunate enough to have worked on some big research projects at Atlassian and worked alongside some of the researchers on the team over there. So I had been exposed to how they had approached those research projects and learned a lot from that. As we got further into that process and we were trying to figure out, you know, product strategy and what we should prioritize from all of those ideas, that was a new challenge for me and a new stretch. But on the design execution side, I had learned so much from Atlassian that I could just get right in there.
And so what was the, I guess, second tool you needed to learn that was really important to get to the next level?
Well, yeah, as I said, as we got further into that research project and we had all of these ideas at Dovetail, we got very excited by our ideas and we're very ambitious. So we want to do everything, but we only had a small team. So you have to kind of ruthlessly prioritize and then take this business lens to what are we going to work on first? And that was new to me. As a designer at Atlassian, which is such a big company, you don't really get exposed to what's the business goal here and how are we going to prioritize our product work in line with a business goal. That was new to me. So I remember us reading lots of like product management books and resources and trying to figure out an efficient way that we could feel confident in what the first thing we were going to work on was. There is no easy answer.
There is not. And as an individual contributor at that time, what was the sort of framework or criteria where you would ship some work and be proud of it? You would be able to know that it was a high quality piece of work.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I love the most about Dovetail is because we're a design-led product team and the founder is a designer and everyone who works here has this appreciation of quality of the user experience and design. That's what we value when we're working on the product. And personally, I never want to ship something that I feel like is a shitty experience for the user, where we've had to make so many compromises on the experience that I just know that it's going to be a poor user experience. So for me and for the early team, we would often de-scope work in order to be able to polish the experience. So ship less, but make it better. And that principle, I guess, has carried through the team as we've scaled the Dovetail team. For me, that's what it is. If we have this idea and we're not able to ship the entire solution to the quality bar that we're happy with, then we'll de-scope and take a more iterative, incremental approach so that we're able to deliver something that we're proud of and happy with.
So you said make it better. Are you able to share either by example or by rule of what that sort of looks like and what that journey from chaos to clarity looks like from a designer's point of view?
Yeah, maybe I can talk to a specific example of a feature that we were working on back then. So we had to introduce comments to the product. This was very early days. It's a very table stakes feature, but Dovetail's a collaborative tool. People comment on things to collaborate. And there's so much prior art out there for what a good commenting feature looks like. So we're able to learn a lot from what other products have done and take the parts of, you know, a good commenting experience that we enjoy in the tools that we use and then learn from the mistakes that other tools have made. The trade-off that we're always making in product development is we want to get value out to customers quickly, but then we also want it to be good quality. So how we balance speed and quality. And I remember we we often start broad with the design, like what's the vision for commenting in Dovetail? And I remember we had things like being able to resolve comments, being able to like comments, being able to reply in a thread, being able to go back and look at resolved comments, comment history, basically the most feature-rich commenting feature you could think of. And then I work with the engineers to figure out how much time that's going to take. And then we, as a team, we think about, well, what's our appetite for solving this problem? We want people to be able to comment in Dovetail, but how long do we want to dedicate to this problem? We've got other problems that we want to solve. So are we going to spend, you know, 3 months just on commenting? Probably not. So then we start to de-scope the feature from there. And so you always want to go back to the user problem that you're trying to solve. That's the most important thing. We want people to be able to collaborate in Dovetail, and what are the features or the workflows necessary for people to be able to do that? And then how can we make that the best experience? That's the trade-off that we're always making in product.
I love that. And you've mentioned table stakes a couple of times. You also mentioned that there was plenty of benchmarks out there that you could use as inspiration of quality. When you're taking the next step into a differentiator, something that's new and unique to Dovetail, what does that journey look like from a design lens?
Yeah, good question. Designing table stakes features, as you said, there's a lot of prior art to look at, and you get to learn from what's worked well and what hasn't worked well in other tools. And that's quite a satisfying design process, because you've probably used commenting features, for example, in so many tools, and you know what bugs you about them. As a designer, you have an eye for detail, so you probably focus more on commenting patterns than other people would. Mm-hmm. And then you get to create a solution that you know is going to be really good or you feel really proud of. Designing a differentiating feature is really exciting, because that's where you get to be creative. You get to come up with something new and create an innovative solution to a problem. But it's hard, because usually there isn't a competitor to copy from, or, you know, some mistakes that you can learn from. So you're often taking inspiration from maybe similar experiences in software products. It might not be a direct competitor. It could even be taking inspiration from something that's not a software product. And it's a much more iterative process, and there's more validation involved. So you might come up with some early ideas and then test those with users or get some feedback on those and then iterate on them a bit more and then get some more feedback. So it's a bit of a longer process, but it's really fun, because that's where you get to kind of exercise your creativity as a designer.
Totally. I'd imagine that'd be so much fun. So we've sort of covered a bit of the 5 to 12 to 15 mark. What was the difference as an individual contributor at something like, say, 20, maybe 30 people? What were some of the challenges that you ran into as the business scaled?
So at about, I would say, 20 people, that's probably when I had to start thinking about building the design team.
Yeah.
So hired the second designer, Jody. So growing a team was a whole new challenge for me. That's one thing. But from a product lens, as the product team grows, you go from being one product team where everyone has context on what everyone's working on. You're usually working on one or two projects as a team, to breaking up into smaller teams and having separate streams of work going on. And then you have cross-team dependencies. You need to scale your rituals and your processes and ways of working and how you capture work across different groups of people. You also need to scale your prioritization process. Like, how are we chipping away at our product strategy, or how are we prioritizing the right work that's going to move the needle on our business goals across multiple teams? Those were all scaling challenges. But the biggest for me was growing the design team and thinking about our design system across multiple teams and multiple people. All of that becomes more complicated as you have more people.
I love that. And what were some of the design systems, or better put, what were some of the design system lessons that you can share?
Yeah. As a small team who's moving really quickly, you don't want your design system to be too restrictive, because that's going to slow you down. you want to be able to kind of grow your design system organically with the product. The product evolves quite quickly, and you want to be able to evolve your design language with the product. So we let it grow organically until we probably got to about 5 designers. When you have a small number of designers, you can be close enough that you can just have a shared understanding of how components work and what components we have in the library and some of the design rules and principles that we use when we're designing the UI. But once the team gets to about 5 and then the engineering team gets bigger, that's where details can slip through the cracks. And for us at Dovetail, where we have such a high quality bar, especially for the details, that's not something that we wanted to let slip.
Yeah.
So then we started to be more thoughtful about how we're refining the design system. For us, the biggest problem to solve was the language between design and engineering, and how can we use the same components in the Figma designs as we are in the code, and how can we make sure that what's in the code matches what's in Figma. So things like our naming conventions were different. We're trying to align those, how we onboard new engineers to the design system and make them aware of what components are available, something that we're focusing on. So yeah, it's sort of a forever evolving problem as we scale, but those were some of the things that we thought about in the early days.
And when you say design systems and patterns are growing organically, in my mind, I'm now like going, oh, does that mean it became chaotic to the point of we should probably do something about this now? Is that fair?
It does kind of ebb and flow like that, yeah. Like things sort of, it's a little bit of the Wild West, things get a bit out of control, and then we're like, okay, we need to kind of come back in here and clean up, and then things are clean. And it is sort of cyclical like that, yeah.
I'm glad you raised that. So in terms of the team, what did you learn about your first hire and going through that process of who would be a right fit? Now they've onboarded. Do I get someone who can solve a problem that will fill something that I don't have time for? Or do you want to bring someone who has a unique perspective given that toolkit analogy that you used before? What can you share there?
Yeah, I was so, so lucky with my first hire, Jody, because she is incredible.
Thanks, Jody.
And it was something I was really nervous about because I had never hired someone before. I'd never grown a team. And when we were that size, every new hire added something to our culture. And so you really felt it. Yeah. So I was quite thoughtful about what problems we had in the product team and what kind of designer we needed. Going back to that toolbox analogy, what tools, what skills do we need on the team? Benjamin and I have quite a good balance. I wanted someone who was going to add new skills, but then also we need people who are really strong at UX and systems thinking for Dovetail as a product. So that was really important. I designed the interview process to look for those particular skills. I followed a very standard interview process that is the same at Google and Atlassian and all of those companies. But I had lots of conversations with Jody before she joined to understand what she wants out of her career and make sure that Dovetail was going to be the right fit for her. Yeah, and it thankfully worked really well. But as I grow the team, I am always thinking about what skills do we need in this design team? What does the product team need? What's going to have a balanced, diverse design team that everyone can kind of learn new skills off each other and grow as individual contributors? But then also what is going to help us achieve our product goals?
I imagine like optimizing for speed and productivity is this constant evolving beast that you're trying to figure out, especially as you're scaling. And so as you were growing the team, how did you think about, oh, we're operating really smoothly right now, or you know what, there's some slack that we need to remove from the system? What did fast for you look like, and fast and high quality?
Yeah, design hiring is kind of dependent on engineering hiring. For me, I have to figure out the ratio of design to engineering. We have a ratio of about 1 designer to 6 engineers, I think, and that feels like a good ratio for us. At Atlassian, I think it was 1 designer to 8 engineers when I first started there. So it just sort of depends on the company culture and how fast the engineers move and I guess the responsibilities of the designer and the team. But for us, that feels like a good ratio. So as we hire more engineers, I need to be thinking about how we're hiring more designers. And someone gave me some advice very early on when we were growing the team, which was like the most important thing that you can do as a design leader is not get behind on your design hiring. If you're behind on your design hiring, you put pressure on the design team. So that's something I've tried to be very thoughtful of. And I want to make sure that we have the capacity to execute on the product work, but then also scale our design function. So working on things like our design system takes time. And I want to make sure that we have the space to do that, as well as the space to talk to our customers regularly, develop our artifacts like our personas and our journey maps and the way that we understand our customers, to have the capacity to run co-design workshops with customers and with the team. All of these things that make a great design function take time and capacity. So I want to make sure that we're not so hamstrung that we can't do those things.
Mm. And when in the ratio do you begin the hiring process? So like you've got ratio of 1 to 4 designers and now it's like, well, we're about to hire 2. Is it that simple?
It's not simple at all. And I've definitely made some mistakes along the way. By the time I hired Jody, I was so over capacity and stretched so thin.
Yeah.
I really should have hired her, you know, 1 to 20 before I did. So that was a big learning for me. And then I really felt how getting behind on hiring can impact the team. So yeah, it's not easy. And, you know, it's hard to fill a pipeline. It takes a while to hire a role. So you almost want to start hiring before, you know, months before you need that person. But in such a fast moving startup, you don't really know when that's going to happen. And then there have been all these changes in the economy that have changed hiring plans. There have been times where we've probably had 1 too many designers and then times when we've not had enough. But I think that having too many is better than not having enough, having been on both sides. The ratio is different at every company and it just depends on your product. And there's no formula to figure out the ratio. That's just like my gut feel that 1 designer to 6 engineers feels good at Dovetail at the moment. So it's something you always have to keep a pulse on. And I'm always talking to my designers, like, how do you feel stretched thin? Do you have enough time to do X, Y, Z? Like, how are we tracking here? There's a lot of things that designers can do. The skills in the toolbox are so versatile that there's always value designers can add to the business, whether it's designing the product or facilitating conversations or framing goals or problems. So I try to lean on the side of more design capacity.
Mm. You mentioned at the beginning, and I mean, you've mentioned it a few times, like whenever you're solving a problem, you say, I design the interview process, or you design selling an idea to stakeholders or storytelling. And so when you think of the word design, what are sort of the steps that you take to solve a problem?
It's so funny. We were talking about this recently with my design team. We had a design team retro and we were just talking through one of the areas to improve that we identified, and we were talking through it like it was a design problem. And we were just laughing about how everything's a design problem. But it's true. It's just a way to solve problems. So, I mean, the first thing you do is orient on the problem or what you're trying to solve or the goal. Like, what are we trying to get out of this here? So when I'm designing an interview process, it's like, I want to hire a designer who is going to be the right fit for the team from a skill set point of view, from a culture point of view, et cetera. So you're doing some like diagnostics on what we're trying to achieve here. And then you go, it's a double diamond, which everyone has seen, design thinking. You go broad on solutions, like what are some different ways we could achieve this? Then you converge in on one idea that you feel good about. Then you go broad again on the different ways that we could execute on that idea. And you converge again on your next steps or what you're going to do. And that is how I approach pretty much everything.
That bloody double diamond, which I haven't heard in years. So when you go through that convergence process from these are all our ideas, and you talked about it a little earlier and I wanted to circle back on it, What are some of the typical ways that you prioritize and synthesize down into the best idea that should be at least tested?
Yeah, there's so many things to take into consideration, like what is feasible, what's a pragmatic approach here. But then I think what's most important is always going back to the problem. Like, you want to make sure that you're solving that problem. And then sometimes throughout that double diamond process, on whatever it is you're designing, whether it's an interview process or a feature or whatever, a new product, throughout that process, sometimes people lose sight of the original problem. You go broad on ideas, you get really excited about something. But if you're not solving that original problem or goal, then you weren't successful. So when you're converging, it's important to always go back to that original problem.
Mm-hmm. So you did say earlier, and I wanted to circle back to that too, designing the story to influence people. What is the role of influencing others in design? Tell me more about that.
Yeah, a big part of a designer's role is influencing stakeholders, because it's your job to align on the problem, design the solution, but then you want to get buy-in to build this solution. And you typically need buy-in from product managers, engineers, and leadership stakeholders. Like, this is the direction we're going to take the product in. And so bringing people along that journey of how you've got to that solution, that entire double diamond process or whatever it was, is really important. You want to show people, like, this is the customer pain, or this is the opportunity and what we're trying to solve here. And this is the process we've gone through, and we've come up with this solution as the best way for us to solve this problem, and have everyone on the team feel really good about that. And there's two different types of stakeholders you typically have to influence as a designer. One is leadership, so that the leadership team feels confident that this is the thing we're going to build that's going to move the needle on our business goals. And the team who are going to work on the solution, so typically the engineers, you want them to understand how their work contributes to the business goals, the customer problem, and feel motivated and inspired, and also contribute ideas and understand how their work ladders up to the bigger picture. So a big part of design is storytelling and influencing, facilitating, bringing people along for the ride.
And how do you, can you share an example of a story that you told that went well? Maybe you had to, the hill you had to climb was a bit more vertical and you learned a lot about storytelling. So perhaps share what you did really well in that use case.
Yeah, sure. It's actually, as I've grown in my career, it's become harder because as you grow into leadership, the kind of problems that I'm thinking about are at a much higher level. And then communicating that to the team, there's just more to thread.
Yeah.
Whereas when I was a IC designer working on a comment feature, it's quite easy to orient the team around the value behind a commenting feature. Yeah. But now, you know, some of the problems that I'm thinking about, for example, at the moment, is how we can increase engagement in the tool. And that's such a high level problem. And for me as a leader, I want the engineering team to feel motivated and understand that the improvements that they're making to the sharing dialogue help us to improve engagement. And so there's a lot of layers to that story. That's probably one of the biggest learnings that I've had at Dovetail growing into this role. And again, it always comes back to the user problem that you're trying to solve. That's what people get really motivated about. So even if you've got this kind of high level business goal, if you can layer it with user goals or user problems, people can build empathy for that and get around that. And then I've also learned that you have to, like, continuously communicate, over communicate the value behind that work and what we're trying to achieve. Because you can write a blog or you can do a presentation, but people need to hear things over and over again to absorb information. One thing that's always worked well at Dovetail is having a very collaborative process. So you can never just tell someone, do this, and it's important for these reasons. Even in a leadership role, running essentially co-design sessions where you're aligning the team around a problem, and then getting their input on what the solutions could be is the best way to build buy-in.
You mentioned over-communicate. What does that look like?
Yeah, I think it's frequency. I think the other thing is people learn and absorb information in different ways. And so how you communicate it, we have a bit of a blog writing culture at Dovetail, but not everyone absorbs information from a blog. So I write blogs, I talk at our all hands company meeting every month. As designers, we have the ability to visualize ideas, which is a really powerful tool. So that's another way that we communicate. And then, yeah, communicating in these different forums like sprint planning and company all hands, design team meetings, just regularly reinforcing how this work ladders up to the bigger picture and why it's important has been successful.
That's really cool. And what is the job description of a head of design? Write it for us.
Well, in a fast-growing startup, your job description is always a bit ambiguous. You just kind of do what needs to be done. And having spoken to other heads of design, I know that the role can vary a lot at different companies. But for me personally, I guess I am ultimately accountable for the success of the design function at Dovetail. So that looks like aligning the team on the problems or opportunities that we want to focus on, hiring the right skill sets and scaling the team, defining our rituals and ways of working and our systems, like our design system. I also people manage the team. So making sure that they have opportunities to learn and grow and knowing where they want to go in their careers. I work really closely with the product leadership group on the product strategy and high-level product prioritization. And then I'm also a part of the company leadership team, where I work really closely with other leaders across the business on whatever the top problems are in the company at that time. It could be a culture thing. It could be like a revenue thing, a self-serve thing. It is just whatever is the top problem to focus on at that time. So it's a bit of a mix, which I really like about the role.
That's unreal. You mentioned design rituals. What's that?
Yeah, so we have a few rituals that are sacred to the design team. One we call design detention, and the other is design sparring. Designers love a brand, so everything has to be branded. They're two actually pretty standard rituals that a lot of design teams have. Usually they're called collaboration and critique. Yeah. We call our collaboration detention, and that is a 3-hour block every week. It's every Tuesday morning. There is no real agenda to the time, but it is time to work on problems together. And so it's called detention because you have to be there, and it is a sacred time in the calendar. And so we all get in a room together. We usually start with a show and tell, which is sort of like a stand up, but you get to show something that you're working on, go through what we're currently working on. And then sometimes people have a problem they want everyone to give input on. So it turns into maybe an ideation session or getting advice or ideas on an approach to a problem. Sometimes it's giving feedback on a detailed design. Sometimes we split up into pairs, like someone says, hey, I would really like some visual design help on this problem. And someone else has something that they want some research help with. So we split up and work on problems separately. Sometimes it's just time to all be in the same room working on our work together, but you've got kind of an opportunity to pull other people into your process. And that collaboration time is so important because design is so diverse in terms of skill sets and we have different strengths on the team. So we want to really make sure that we're learning from each other and using each other to make our solutions better. So that's one thing. And then we have sparring, which is essentially critique, which is time for designers to get pretty specific feedback on their work. So it's usually facilitated in sort of a structured workshop style. Designers will present something they're working on, they'll really make sure that the rest of the group understands the problem, walk through their solution, and they'll ask for quite specific feedback. And then it sort of turns into a debate. That's why it's called sparring, because there's a bit of back and forth. So someone will challenge a design decision, and then that designer has the opportunity to make their justification. And the idea behind it is to stress test solutions and make the solutions stronger. So those are the two rituals that we have. And then we also have things like team bonding time, which is really important if you're going to have those kinds of rituals like sparring where you're going to challenge each other. It has to come from a place of trust.
What's the right kind of sparring? Do you have a way that you celebrate a healthy debate?
Well, everyone has the same goal. Like, everyone wants the solution to be the best solution we can create for the users. So even though there's this back and forth, it comes from a place of wanting to work as a team. So even for the people who are asking for feedback, they want the feedback, they want to make their work stronger, and then the people who want to help. So even though it sounds kind of like aggressive with the sparring metaphor, it comes from a place of being on the same team and working towards the same goal. So it always sort of ends in like a, that was really good. And that was a great thought process that you went through there.
I love that response. You mentioned business goals, and then you spoke about you're currently thinking about engagement. To what extent do business goals creep into your job description as the head of design?
Quite a lot. So at Dovetail, we have company goals. We have 5 company level goals. I'm the owner of one of them. So that's really one of my top priorities, is making sure we hit that goal. That's my company leadership role. But the whole purpose of design is to, you know, create solutions that customers will love so that they'll buy them and will have business impact. So design is quite tied to business outcomes. And then it's quite a tangible craft. So it's sort of easy to tie design to business impact.
And what are some examples of business impact that you focus on?
Yeah, so I am the owner of this engagement goal at the moment, which is why it's top of mind for me. Unpacking that goal, just as an example, we want to increase engagement in the tool. We've got these 2 use cases. We have this analysis use case and this consumption of research use case. We know that we're growing into that consumption use case and that there's a lot of areas for opportunity for us to increase engagement in the tool by leaning into that use case. And then from a design point of view, we can look at where are the friction points in the current experience that prevent people from consuming research. So we're sort of breaking down this goal. We use this framework called Red Roots to understand where the high friction points are in the current experience. So your Red Roots are your highly critical, frequently used user journeys in the product. They're the things that users go through all the time and they have to go through to reach their goals and get value out of the tool. They're called Red Roots. They're named after the roads in London. As I said, designers love a brand, but they're like the main arteries of the city. And so the idea is that they're supposed to be seamless user journeys in your product. So going back to our engagement goal, we know that we're growing into this consumption use case and that there are gaps in the experience that prevent engagement or slow down engagement. And then we can look at those user journeys and identify where the friction points are in those journeys that might be contributing to that problem. And from there, we identified like it's really hard to share content from Dovetail and that prevents consumers coming into the tool. So then we can start to design an experience or dig into the problems around sharing from Dovetail and start our design process there. And we will look at things like, you know, number of shares from the tool, number of viewers in the tool, these kind of more granular product metrics that then ladder up to the engagement goal. So we have confidence that if we can improve sharing, or if we can increase the number of viewers coming into the tool, we can increase engagement. And that's how we would kind of layer a really high level company goal like that and then tie it to design work.
That's really cool. Oftentimes at the early stage or the earlier stages of a company, but I imagine it's no matter what size the company is, what I'm about to say is a really challenging one, which is how do you inspire people to do what often looks like boring work or monotonous work or not the differentiator products? And I guess like what I'm alluding to here is that because you have such a clear engagement goal, you should be able to at least show to an extent what a design will do, at least in theory. But I'd love to hear how you think about engaging people in the team, what their workloads look like, and yeah, what does that buy-in look like at a team level?
Yeah, this is where that storytelling skill is so important, because people get motivated by customer problems, solving customer problems and solving customer pain. And so even something that seems boring or small or not a differentiating feature, like improving the sharing experience, you know, it solves a customer problem and it makes a difference to the customer experience. And so if you're able to inspire people with that and kind of build empathy for the user and help them to understand what this is going to unlock for users in their day-to-day workflows, people get really motivated by that. But when you have this really high-level goal that's just increase engagement, and then you've got the team working on improving the share dialogue, how you thread the needle to how this product work is going to help us achieve our goal and the customer problems that we're solving by doing this is really important. So it always comes back to what problem we're solving for the user.
And from a leadership style point of view, how hands-off or hands-on are you? The reason I called that out was one way to frame the comments piece is we don't have comments. Another way to frame it is customers can't comment on a bit of research that they're doing. So I'm curious how much information you need to give about that customer problem and for them to run off and build.
Mm-hmm. We always try to frame things as opportunities. It's not that customers can't comment and that's bad. There's an opportunity to improve how people collaborate on research and build buy-in with their stakeholders by building collaborative features in the tool, and commenting is the way that people want to do that today. And then it gives people, you know, a bit more autonomy to come up with what other collaborative features are there that we could build. Like, that's the goal, is we want to improve collaboration in Dovetail, and commenting is one way we could do that. What are some other ways we could do that?
You mentioned Red Roots, and that was a new learning for me. What other brands or models of thinking do you constantly lean on?
We have a growth model, which sort of visualizes a healthy Dovetail workspace with our two use cases. So we've got how the analysis use case fuels the consumption use case. Essentially, the more people you have coming in, creating content, analyzing research and creating insights, the more people you have coming in, consuming that research and learning from research and making decisions, answering questions, making decisions. So we have this visualization of what a healthy workspace looks like. And we use that to kind of diagnose where in our product experience there could be friction towards our engagement goal.
Love that. What else?
What else?
I feel like I should just keep asking because the responses are so good.
What else?
I think I have some mind. That's cool.
Well, we have our personas. We have 5 customer personas that came from our research. Everyone knows what personas are, right?
But maybe give an example and like how you think about like a persona.
There are articulations of the types of people who interact with Dovetail. It could be the product, it could be the sales process, it could be the procurement process. We have 5 personas. They're sort of split into people who do research and are creating content, people who use that research to make decisions, and then enablers of research. So people who might be setting up the tool or purchasing the tool or creating a company culture around customer-centric decisions. And we mostly use those to build alignment on the problems with the team. So we can all have a shared understanding of who our users are. So we can start with that deep user understanding, and then we can go broad on the solutions from there. So we have that. We also have a high-level research journey that helps us understand where, again, helps us be aligned as a team on a researcher's workflow or a user's workflow, and where in the experience the feature we're talking about or the problem we're talking about fits in. We also have a set of user needs. I guess we do have quite a lot of things, artifacts that we use. We have a set of user needs. We have 7 user needs that came from our research as well. And those are kind of like 7 principles for how we develop the product, what users really need from the tool. To give an example, one is that the tool needs to be integratable. It needs to integrate with a user's workflow. So there are lots of ways that researchers collect data, and then there's lots of ways that teams connect research insights to their product development workflows or their decision-making workflows. And it's important to our users that Dovetail fits into their workflow. So it has to be integrated. So when we're designing solutions, that's something that we need to consider, is how does this integrate with the user's workflow?
That's unreal. What are the others?
Oh, wow. You're really testing me. One is traceable. It's important for researchers to be able to reuse prior knowledge, that they're able to trace it back to the original data source. So you might have a quote from a customer saying, you know, I really love this navigation design, whatever it is. That might be shared around Slack. It might be in a research report. It could be out of context. But then in order to reuse research data in different contexts, you need to understand what design prototype was shown to that user when they said that, what question was asked, what type of user was that, what point in time. You know, you need all of that context to be able to make sense of that data. So the data being traceable is important.
Gold. I would love to know the others if you know them off the top of your head. Otherwise, don't worry about it. But I just find it fascinating.
One is findable, shareable, integratable, traceable. Now it's going to bother me. I have them open right here because I was talking about them the other day. Oh, trustworthy. There's a lot of sensitive data in research. So researchers want to feel confident in the tool. Customizable is a really important one. There's lots of different ways to do research, lots of different methods you can use. And so being able to customize the tool to work for your workflow is important. And efficient, another super important one. There's a lot of importing and exporting and reformatting of data throughout the research process. And research is often combating this brand that it's slow, because a lot of the research methods that people use in commercial settings come from academic research, which is kind of slow, but it's very thorough and it needs to be because it's academic. But in a commercial setting, it doesn't really need to be as thorough. But we're sort of reshaping these methods from academic research to work in a commercial setting. So in a commercial setting, insights we need to know them quickly. So efficiency is really important.
How often do you remove or edit designs? Like, in my mind, there's this constant tension with customizability and the risk of becoming like a houseboat product where you just sort of keep adding functionality and then, well, it becomes a houseboat. And I'm curious how often you will revisit what you have and reduce and simplify.
Mm-hmm. That's a really important part of being design-led, is that you're continuously learning and iterating. And it's probably one of the biggest learnings for me and a few other people on the team who worked on Jira, which is a very feature-rich, very advanced tool. that's one way of putting it. But yeah, being design-led is always continuously learning and iterating on the experience. And so we come back and remove features or parts of the product or simplify the experience quite a lot. That's something that we're trying to be really intentional about, because we have seen from our experience on other tools how it can kind of get away from you. You just keep adding features and adding features, and it makes the experience more overwhelming than it is helpful. So that's something that we do quite a lot.
What in a scaling team enables that progression of complexity to build, and what can founders and designers look out for, and how have you been thoughtful about this process of simplification?
Mm-hmm. Once you have a product and you have users, you get so many feature requests, and it's really easy to just build everything that everyone asks you to build. But you have to be quite thoughtful about what problem that's solving. How does that fit into your existing feature set? One person has asked for it. Does that mean that everyone has this problem? There's a lot of things to consider. And you also have to balance building what your current customers are asking for versus building those differentiating features and expanding your product offering to new users. But I think that people can get quite excited by customers engaging in the tool and giving you feedback and asking for things and just wanting to build those things.
That's useful. Thank you. We're approaching the end. I do have two more questions, so thank you for your time. One is, what sort of mistakes or big challenges have you seen in scaling the business? Or have other design leaders you mentioned you've spoken to a few told you to watch out for this pit hole?
That's a good question. I think one of my biggest learnings is, especially when you're building the differentiating features, is being quite thoughtful about how you're validating those ideas. It's pretty easy to kind of jump ahead in that double diamond process and get really excited by an idea and be really ambitious and want to build the entire solution to a problem. But in order to have that iterative learning, you want to take a very incremental approach so that you can continue to get feedback on the idea and then continue to iterate it and build a really strong solution. And I think that there have been times where we've got really excited by the idea and then we're so ambitious and we want to execute on this vision and so we want to build the whole thing, but that has led us down the wrong path and then you sort of have to go back to square one. So just being patient and ruthlessly prioritizing what is going to have an impact on the problem, being super pragmatic about how you prioritize work, iteratively chipping away at solutions, and then always listening to your customers and continuing to learn and improve the experience.
That's a really helpful segue into, what sort of attributes do you look for in people, especially when you're
for the designer
hire? Yeah.
Yeah, I think at Dovetail in particular, the scope of the design role is quite broad because we don't have product managers. Our designers are talking to customers, they are looking at competitors, they're understanding the market. Because the team is small, our designers have all the context on the business problems and how that ladders up to how the work ladders up to those business goals. So someone who is really keen to be an end-to-end designer and lean into understanding the business is really important. Someone who is a good storyteller is really important. Someone who is a good facilitator of the solution design, who can work really closely with engineers, someone who's a good collaborator with our engineering partners. Those are the things that I look for. And then for whatever role it is, whether we need someone who's strong in UX or UI or visual design or systems thinking, we look for that too. But those are kind of the consistent skills that are important at Dovetail.
And how do you think about trade-offs when it comes to hiring and like, for example, there's like the classic, the hungry over the proven, but I can even sense in the way that your career has grown, it's like, I don't really have any skills built like tying design to business outcomes, but you've been able to figure that out. So perhaps share more about the core traits you're looking for, because you can bet that over time, they'll be able to figure X, Y, and Z out, which are the table stake features that you described.
Mm-hmm. I definitely look for someone who is really keen to learn. That's super important. And that often comes with the hungry people. Mm-hmm. As the team scales, I think we do need a mix of people who have had experience with different types of problems and have kind of seen what good looks like, versus people who have a fresh perspective on how to approach a problem. You need a bit of a balance of that.
Mm.
When the team was smaller, we probably had more executors. So people who were just like keen to get in the weeds, execute on the work, move quickly, learn fast. As the company scales and we have more complex problems, I think that we need more of a balance of, yeah, people with experience with the different types of problems that we're facing, and then people who are keen to execute and move quickly.
So I think that's a really useful model. As you sort of like abstract to different scales of the business, you're looking for different elements of, we have like so many awesome executors, but perhaps we need more of the storytelling elements so that they can help unlock those executors further.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And from my experience, I would say, you know, if you're hiring your first designer, you want an executor. I have seen some companies hire, you know, a really senior design leader as the first design hire. The challenge, I guess there's pros and cons, you know, that person will then be able to hire executors and maybe they know what to look for, whereas you didn't if you don't have a design background. Yep. But that person's probably going to struggle to get back into the weeds and actually have an impact on the product that you're building.
Yeah.
So if I was starting a company, I'd start with someone who could, you know, execute. And in the earlier days, when you do have to build a lot of kind of table stakes features just to like get to a certain benchmark, you know, there are lots of really talented product designers who can do that kind of work and you can grow from there. That's what I would do.
Thank you so much, Lucy. That was packed and I absolutely loved it. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for tuning into this episode. If you left with more energy than when you started, we'd be super grateful if you liked, subscribed, left a review, even shared it with a friend. In case you want to keep in touch, share feedback, or even a pitch deck, I'll leave my Blink card in the show notes for you to get in touch. Thank you so much for listening once again, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks. Godspeed.